Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and you've just got me today. Caroline will be back with us next week, and probably by the time you're listening to this, she will have just turned 85, which is happening on June 8th of 2020. So kind of an odd time to be celebrating birthdays because of the coronavirus, and we've had some fun things planned for her, like trying to get as many people to send cards as possible. And if you haven't sent a card and you'd like to, you can send it care of me, Monica Hadley, at P.O. Box 337, Fairfield, Iowa, 52556, and it doesn't matter that it's a little late. Anyway, let's get on with the show. Today, we have Anne Crawford, a fun-loving, world-traveling, high-flying, deep-diving, and living-to-the-max author of 10 books. She's also a screenwriter and award-winning filmmaker and humanitarian. Currently, she lives in Colorado, and Anne is a number one Amazon best-selling and multiple award-winning author. The novel that we're talking about today is Life in the Hollywood Lane. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Anne.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, how long have you been writing novels?
Usually the question is, how long have I been writing? And my answer is, since I was three. Since I could hold a pencil. How long have I been writing novels? 35 years. I'd say I put the first word of a novel that actually became a book to paper 35 years ago.
Wow. And when did that novel get published?
It never did. I got an agent for it, a very top-notch, successful agent who loved the book, and she said, oh, I'm going to sell it this summer, and that never happened. But I just kept going. And my third one got published. That one's called Visioning.
And do you feel like that was the right path, that the other two maybe weren't quite ready for publication, and by the third one you got it right, or was it just some other reason going on there?
I'd say that was right, that they weren't really what I ended up writing. And the first book was really good, but it looking back, I'm glad it wasn't. I was in this for the marathon. I didn't know that. Well, I mean, I figured I would be a lifetime writer at the time, but I was so disappointed. But I'm really in this for the long haul.
What made you want to be a writer?
My mom was really, really sick when I was a child. She died when I was a teenager. But she did read to me. And much of the time she was just sick in bed and unable to do anything. But those times where she read to me were just magical for me. I remember just being really cozy with her. And I wanted to bring that magic. What those books brought to me, I wanted to bring that to other people. So it was always in my head that I'd be a writer, and it just took till my 20s to really get going with it.
Well, that's not too long. That's not too late to get started. We've had guests who started writing novels in their 50s. So,
and I think Laura Ingalls Wilder was in her 60s when she got going.
I think you're right. I think you're right. Now, you have done other kinds of writing, too. Could you tell us a little bit about your background in screenwriting, for example?
Well, I've written a number of screenplays, and a few of my books have been turned into screenplays by me, and I have an agent for those, and that's even harder than getting published. So,
well, true, because probably thousands of books get published every year, and how many movies get made?
I heard it's something crazy, like 70,000 books are being published every month now. It's just wild. Because everybody can do it themselves.
Yeah, you know? But that doesn't mean they all should be.
Right.
not to be snarky, but, you know, and I know there's great things about self-publishing, and there's some great books that have been self-published, but it makes it a little challenging for the readers, because the old way, where you had the publishing houses, and there were, you know, only so many of them, and the editors there were the filter for the rest of the reading population.
The gatekeepers.
Yeah, they were the gatekeepers, which, you know, has a negative connotation, but they were also the filter, because it's so hard to figure out, when there's tens of thousands of books, what do you want to read next?
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. I've read a few. I've had people want me to read their books, and it's like, oh dear. I do start them, and it's like, oh,
yeah.
You need an editor.
Yeah. Now, have you ever been part of a writer's group?
No, I can't say I have. I've taken classes, and I've even been taking classes in stand-up comedy lately, and I'm in an improv group.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because in Life in the Hollywood Lane, your character, your main character, Trish, she's an actress. She's been trying since, age 19 or something to break in Hollywood.
Right.
And she's had some success, but not as much as she would like to have had. And kind of the book is really partly about coming to terms with that. And understanding what she really needs to be happy in life. But one of the things that she does and seems to really get a lot out of is improv.
Improv is so great. There's a section in the book titled, Almost every great thing I learned in my life, I learned from improv. And it's true. It's about working on a team and sharing with each other and giving each other gifts that they can take and fly with. If we could all do that in life, my goodness, what a wonderful life we'd have.
How long have you been doing improv?
4 years.
Wow.
And stand up just for a year. And of course, it all got stopped for a while, but hopefully not for too much longer.
I was in an improv troupe, 20 years ago, maybe more. And here in Fairfield, Iowa. And it was so much fun.
Oh, that's really wonderful.
Was. Yeah. And I haven't done any other real live acting other than like in high school. But I did some stand up too. So it's a lot of fun. But the stand up is very nerve wracking. Improv, I didn't really get nervous so much with improv.
Right.
Part of it is because it is a team sport, and it's not all on you.
And it's all a big game, and you're just playing a game with each other. And if you blow it, there's another show, or your teammates will pick up for you, or you'll pick up for one of them who's having an off night or something like that.
Right.
With stand-up, I get so nervous, but then it kind of goes away when I'm on stage because I'm having so much fun.
I didn't do very much. I did a few events, I think maybe three. And I had taken a class with a friend on how to do stand-up, and we did, you know, we had a graduation ceremony. And then three of us from that class did an event together, and we had like standing room only crowd where we were. And,
wow!
It wasn't a huge room, but it was, and everybody was so supportive. But it's like I could barely even remember being on stage. It's sort of like a blur, you know. And fortunately, my friend had a lot of stage experience, and she was really, really funny. So that helped to have her warming up the crowd.
I have friends who say, I can't believe you do that. I think I'd be sick to my stomach.
Oh, yeah. So this book, Life in the Hollywood Lane, is set in Hollywood. And tell us a little bit more about what inspired this book.
I lived in L.A. for a little bit, and I worked in the talent management industry. And that was the most fun day job I've ever had in my life. And one of our actors, unfortunately, committed suicide. She was so beautiful, so talented. She also did stand up and was very funny. Gorgeous, vivacious, just someone. We were shocked. We were shocked when she did that. And I didn't know her very well. I don't know how much drugs and alcohol played a role. But over the next couple years, her story kept coming to me, and I wanted her to be the hero of her journey, no matter how it ended. So, and the woman who committed suicide had a best friend, and I kept putting myself in the position of the best friend, and that's how Trish came to be. So Trish is the narrator, and her best friend Cindy kills herself, but Cindy shows up throughout the whole book, kind of reminding Trish of things that happened and dreams yet to come true and things like that. So it's based on real life, but it's fictionalized.
And it's written in first person. So,
right.
And a very, I'd say, intimate confessional style.
That's a good way to put it.
Are all of your books written from that perspective? Are they all first person confessionals?
No. I have Angels on Overtime, which is about two humans and eight angels altogether, but two angels in particular. And so that's third person. And then Spellweaver is about a woman during the witch burning. And that's third person. Most of them are actually third person.
So how is writing in this first person, this really, almost stream of consciousness kind of point of view, how does that affect you? You obviously have to really get inside the person's head. Is it hard to back away from it when you're not writing?
No. No, I have such a ritual around writing. When I sit down to do it, it's almost Pavlovian. I get right into it. I play a certain music and have lights on and stuff like that, and I get right into writing mode, and whoever is the main character just comes up to the center of my head. And I mean, for the rest of the day and night and over the weekend, sometimes something will come to me and I'll write it. I keep the notes feature in my iPhone is going all the time because I do get ideas. And I love to tell people that, like, just going back to Spellweaver for a minute, the book about the witch hunts, I did not want to write that book. I did not want to write that particular scene and all of that, but she would not leave me alone. She was like, oh no, you have got to write my story. So I finally just wrote out the worst part of it, that particular scene. And I chunked the rest down where I said, okay, just work on it 10 minutes a day. And of course, 10 minutes would stretch into an hour or something. But the characters do sit in the passenger seat, knock on the shower door, stand outside the kitchen window, saying, here's an idea. Oh, don't forget this one.
Right. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. And our guest today is Anne Crawford, author of Life in the Hollywood Lane. So the character is somewhat younger than you are, and Trish, and she speaks and thinks in a kind of a very modern, kind of millennial speak. So is that you, or if not, how did you absorb that?
Some of it's me. Some of it was from being in LA and being around so many millennials, the actors, and just hearing that language all the time. And I have two stepkids around 30. So I hear their language, I hear them talking, of course. But some of it is the way I talk still, even at my age.
And well, there's a lot of also kind of new, what used to be called New Age philosophy, that this is her kind of worldview. And I'm guessing that you do have a pretty deep understanding of that worldview.
Right, absolutely. All of my books have that worldview behind them throughout the story.
I read on your website, which is annecrawford.net, I was reading a little piece about it where you said somebody was talking about not wanting to read a book about that says it's about spirituality or things like that, but put it in a story. And is that what you're trying to do?
Right. A friend of mine said, don't tell me it's spiritual. I want a good story.
Yeah.
Because spiritual implies you're going to try to teach me something. So I don't try to teach anybody anything. I just incorporate it into the story as best I can.
And what kind of feedback do you get from readers about, you know, that makes you think that that's an effective way to do it?
Well, some hate it, very few, but I have gotten reviews saying, oh, I didn't like it. I felt like she was trying to push her New Age beliefs on me. And well, you're right. not that I was trying to push them on anybody, but just presenting them. But most people, I get a lot of emails through my website saying, I am so glad I found you. I didn't know anybody else thought the way I do. And then they read all of the rest of the books because they can't get enough. So fortunately, I have the people like that far outnumber the others.
Well, that's good. That's good. I also read on your website about how you and your husband met. And I think that is a great story to share.
It is. We're coming up on our 14th anniversary of being matched on eHarmony. We were matched on June 21st, 2006. We met face-to-face on July 14th. We were engaged on July 16th, and I had my little Prius packed up and was moving from a hippie surfer town in Northern California to Topeka, Kansas, where he had those two stepkids who at the time were teenagers.
So you got matched up with somebody. You were in California and you were matched up with someone in Kansas. You cast a pretty wide net there.
Well, I did say the world. And this is a funny story. He was about to say 100 miles from his home, and something said, are you sure about that? So he clicked on the world too, and I was in his first set of matches. So,
oh wow.
He said, you had me at Anne. And then I joke with him in his profile, he was talking about Joel Goldsmith, who is an esoteric writer, and very few people have heard of him. So I tease him. When I came across that, I thought, oh, wow, this is a different kind of match. And so I tease him and I say, you have me at Joel. And his name is Steve. It's not Joel.
Now, you also said in the little essay about this on your website that you were both very clear about what you were looking for, and that's why it moved so quickly. And
very clear.
Yeah. So that's a good thing. Now, you're also a filmmaker?
Yes, I've made two documentaries. One was about Vietnam vets going back to Vietnam and doing humanitarian work and going back to their areas of operation, which was such a magnificent experience. Sometimes the whole town come out to meet us. This was in 94, so it was right after the embargo was lifted, like just very soon after the embargo was lifted. And they weren't used to Westerners as much as they would be since then. So the whole town would come out to meet them. And sometimes we'd find a former soldier who was fighting on the other side, and they'd hug and cry. And it was for these guys, letting go of all those years of guilt for fighting in a war that they thought was really wrong. So that was one of the high points and honors of my life, to be with those guys as they let go of those years of guilt. It was just amazing. And that movie won a very prestigious award. And then the other movie, my ex-husband and I traveled around the world and interviewed people from all walks of life about how we can make world peace. So that was another honor of a lifetime.
Wow.
To do.
How did you become a filmmaker?
Well, getting back to the screenwriting for a minute, I started taking film classes to help with the screenwriting. And I fell in love with it. Okay, this is the history of film here. I fell in love with the light meter and the chopping of the tape and the clapboard. You know, now it's all computerized and everything. But I just fell in love with making movies. So,
and
it's a really hard row to hoe.
Oh, yeah.
Even harder.
Yeah. Did you work in the filmmaking industry in any other, you know, other than making these documentaries?
Not really, no. Other than being a talent manager for a bit.
Yeah.
That's like you mentioned,
that's sort of how you were able to write this book, Life in the Hollywood Lane, from your experience as a talent manager. And part of, there's a lot in the book about sort of how actors may appear to have this perfect life, but there's a lot of insecurity and what they need from the audience, what they give to people. And does that all come from your observations of actors as a talent manager?
Yeah, they're very, all of us humans, or many of us humans, are such tender creatures. And actors, maybe even more so, because they put themselves out there and they have to take on other emotions. So they have to really be in touch with emotions that aren't necessarily theirs in that moment. So I think it makes them more sensitive. And same with writers. We're sensitive creatures too. We have to be inside of other people's heads and feeling their emotions, and even characters we don't like, and we have to love them all anyway. Even the villains.
At least with writers, we don't get judged by our physical appearance. And for actors, where that is also, you know, their success can ride on what they look like, as well as as well as their ability, willingness to work, or willingness to put themselves out there, or talent, or whatever. And that must be really brings some challenges when your career is dependent on your physical appearance.
Right. One blemish can throw off a whole, can mean somebody else gets that role. It's really weird. That's very hard.
Yeah. And then, yeah. You know, not every role requires someone who has, you know, physical beauty, but so there are very successful actors who don't meet our normal definitions of physical beauty.
Right.
And yet they're in a world where most of the people you look around are so beautiful. And I wonder what that does to their self-esteem.
Right. And another thing about acting is you could be doing the role just perfectly, but it depends on who else they're casting. You have to bounce off of them just right with the right chemistry. So you could have given your best audition ever and just know you got the part and you don't get it because you don't mix with the rest of the family or whoever they're casting. Yeah.
Did you ever have any desire to act yourself?
Not really. I did in high school, like you said you did. But no, not really, other than the improv hitting me on the head 4 years ago. You should have seen my husband's face when I said, I think I'm going to take an improv class. What?
So can you describe like one of your favorite improv setups? Or games? I guess do they call them games? Is that?
Well, we do a form called the Herald, which is where you start out with a group game and then you have three acts in the first beat. And then another group game, and then three acts again, and then another group game, and then at the very end, it's all hands on deck. Everything goes crazy. Take everything that was in the beginning part of the whole thing and just go to crazy town with it. Sometimes I feel like that's our life right now.
Yeah, really.
2020 has just been a ride to crazy town.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember there's some like where you ask the audience for two characters in a situation and then you just go from that.
Right.
Or
we usually just ask for one suggestion. And I guess my favorite part is the group games where we're all doing something called flocking. Where we're all doing something similar, a similar movement. And from the audience, it just looks like magic. And we get into a phase of magic up there with each other where we're in sync and it's fun and it's magic.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Anne Crawford, author of Life in the Hollywood Lane. Anne, would you like to read a little bit from the book for us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Okay, the section I'm going to read is Trish, who at this point has been in Hollywood for 21 years, and she's dated more than a few people. So she's talking about her love life here, and she says, well, before this, she's talking about characters in movies, and so then she goes, even more crazy were the characters I dated. There was the roadie I dated whose tailpipe dragged on the road behind his dilapidated car, but he made his bed with perfect hospital corners. I'm all for hospital corners, but it just seemed totally incongruous. What makes us decide which idiosyncrasy to hang our hat on? Then there was Johnson, who didn't seem to have enough sense to turn his name into a genuine first name, let alone something that didn't imply Dick, which he was. Oh, I try to be kind and give people the benefit of the doubt. But after doing that time and again with him, I finally surmised that he reveled in his dickness, his dickosity. He was amazingly handsome, too. Too bad he was so aware of it. One time he actually said, I am so friggin' vain, as well I should be. Then there was the then there was the super rich guy, and the other one, and the other, and even that one with the Richard Branson hairdo, although he wasn't that old. They were all in so into how it all looked, not how it all was. The emphasis was on that not so very serious swag. And part of how it all looked was to have a beautiful date. Cindy definitely had the same problem. Talk about mansplaining, though. They had advanced degrees in that. Ugh. They liked to consider themselves masters of the universe, but they might have been the only ones who did. They could have been such great guys if they could have just calmed the frig down, if they hadn't been pretending so much. Then there was the Uber driver, and the other Uber driver, and the other Uber driver, and the other, although not necessarily in that order. Actually, they were intermingled with the rich guy. Then there was the guy I had to get a restraining order for, and the other. Fortunately, the order worked with both of them. Plus, there was the Burning Man guy, and the dreadlocks guy, and the man bun guy. He was some silver-like hipster back when that was the thing. He was a little younger, which was especially nice after all those older rich guys, but I'm not into long beards and man buns. There was Mr. It Is What It Is guy. I mean, it is what it is, all right, but I didn't have to be reminded every 5 minutes. It might sound like a lot, and I did date a fair bit, but I really only averaged one relationship a year for a few months over the 20-odd years I've been in L.A. They never lasted very long. Now I know why, but I didn't at the time. Oh, people, what a wild bunch we are, quiet and scared of our shadows, outrageously flamboyant to hide that we're scared of our shadows, worried, obsessive, OCD, tightly wound, that was me, drippy and oozy and gorgeous and melodramatic, crossed with easygoing yet suicidal, that was sin. I quickly put on my sunglasses to cover my tears. Sin, sin, sin. That's the end of that chapter.
And that was Anne Crawford reading from Life in the Hollywood Lane. Now, I
now
understand.
You have to say her name is Cindy, which is, but she called
right,
her Sin.
Right.
That's
yeah.
Okay.
Sin was C-Y-N.
Right.
Now, I understand that you like to challenge genre standards in your writing.
Oh, it just comes naturally.
So what are some of the genres that you sort of mix up?
Well, if I had my own genre, it would be called deep and funny. Because all of my books have a depth to them, but they're also funny. I mean, even the Witch Hunt one, not so much, but there were still moments of laughter in there. And I have one about Mary Magdalene, and she even was pretty funny at times. But all the other ones are very funny and very deep. So I throw together visionary fiction, inspirational fiction, romantic comedy, sci-fi, paranormal, for the angels, and one book is called Fresh Off the Starship, and that's about an alien who was supposed to go to Washington, D.C., where she could help on a grand geopolitical scale, but she ended up in Kansas. Speaking of Kansas. So there's sci-fi and paranormal, and sometimes they're all at the same time. Like that one is definitely sci-fi, paranormal, rom-com, deep, funny, humorous, all of the above, women's fiction.
It does seem like there's maybe an element of romance in most of them.
Yeah, there's always a love interest. It's not quite a romance. In fact, when I marketed Angels on Overtime as a romance once, that's where I got that really snarky review. I can't really market them as romance because they're spiritual and visionary and all these other elements rolled into one.
And if somebody's looking for romance, they may not appreciate some of those other elements.
Right. They'll get the love story. All of them have a love story, but they won't get that. I mean, they'll get more than they bargained for.
Even the witch trial one?
That has a very short love story in there.
Yeah, I guess if you're going to get burned at the stake, your love story's not going to last very long. But
Right.
Yeah.
But still powerful.
And can you tell us, in the book, in Life in Hollywood Lane, Trish has... she has a humanitarian interest too, she develops that by sending care packages to inmates.
Yeah.
So
that's based on fact.
Okay.
I used to do that. Yeah. I used to send books and magazine to inmates, and I did get a letter back from, oh my God, I'm going to cry. From this one fellow in Texas, and he said, "Ma'am, I am a hardened criminal. I have tattoos. I'm here for a long time. And when I opened your letter, this wave of love washed over me. I've never experienced anything like that." So, and I have Trish experience that as well, mm-hmm. and that's true.
Oh,
That happened. Yeah.
Now, I work a little bit in justice in criminal justice reform. And my experience here, at least in state prisons, you can't actually send books directly to inmates. They have to come from a bookstore.
I was working for a publisher at the time.
Oh, so, very good.
Yeah. So it came from the publisher. Yeah. Good point.
Yes. Yes. But you also have some humanitarian interests as well.
I do. I've done a lot of anti-death penalty work. And I did a lot of work for Amnesty International for many years, and I ran a humanitarian branch at a spiritual center that I went to, and I used to visit a death row inmate. So yeah, and I've been a mentor, and when I was in Topeka, I developed a where I'd go in and read to the kids at a homeless shelter. I mean, I usually just find something to do. It's had different looks in different phases of my life.
So, Anne, earlier you mentioned that you have a very specific ritual around writing. Would you be willing to go into a little more detail about that?
Sure. I go to bed kind of late, so I wake up around 7. And I have coffee and breakfast. Coffee is a big, important part of the ritual, as is breakfast. And I read for a while. I read the New York Times and lots of news and lots of articles on social media and stuff. I use that time to wake up and get the brain functioning and get ideas flowing. And a lot of those things that I read make their way into books pretty fairly often. And then around 9 o'clock, I sit down and meditate. And it's where I turn on special lights and I meditate for 15 minutes. And then I turn on whatever soundtrack I have. Each book has its own soundtrack. And by then, as soon as those first notes hit, and after all of the reading and meditating and coffeeing I've been doing, then I'm ready to write. And it could be an hour or it could be 6 hours. It depends what kind of flow I get into. And on rare occasions, it doesn't happen very often, but sometimes it's just not flowing. And on those days, I'll just read more. do more research and things like that. But that, like I said, that doesn't happen very often.
So this is like 5 days a week?
Yeah. Yep. Monday through Friday. And I quit my day job a year and a half ago, and the main thing I got when I quit my day job was weekends.
Oh.
Because that's when I used to write, mostly. Well, I'd write in the very early mornings and then all day Sunday. So when I was finally able to quit my day job and write full time, one of my greatest pleasures was having a regular weekend.
And what made you decide, now I can quit my day job?
Well, it was just time to really give it a go. And so my husband and I took our 401ks and just we're giving it a go. And I'm having some success with it. I did finish another book, and I have a top New York agent. And I know, as you've heard, I've been down this road before, but this is a different kind of book. It's very contemporary and relevant. And so she's walking me through the revisions I have to do, which I've never had anybody walk me through and say, okay, this is what you need to do to have a New York Times bestseller.
So you said you and your husband are going for it. So what's he working on?
Well, he's a musician. He's a bass player. But for him, though, right now, that's kind of on hold until the pandemic calms down.
Yeah. So. Yeah. But did he quit his day job, too?
Yep.
Whoa.
Yeah.
You're taking the leap of faith.
Well, we figured it was now or never. We had to do it before, I don't know, 60 or so. And actually, I'm not that far from there anymore.
I actually know exactly how far you are because I saw it on your website.
No. Yeah, as I said on my website, I'm technically almost 60. I don't have an age right now. I'm almost 60.
Well, you can still say you're in your mid to late 50s. How's that?
Well, late 50s. I could still say middle age, really. Kind
oh,
of.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because, of course, the older we get, the more our perspective on it changes, because I'm just a year or two ahead of you. And, you know, 60 used to sound really old. And it doesn't seem nearly as old as it used to. But also, people are living longer. And if you make it to 60, your chances of living quite a while longer are pretty high. And so what I like to think of it is, if I were to live to be 100, I'm only halfway through my adulthood.
Yeah, true. Good point.
Yeah.
I was working on a comedy routine about getting older, and one little thing was, wow, I wake up and it's like, whoa, I'm still here. Open the door and there's death. Whoa, death, 6 feet. Stay away.
My mom likes to talk about, you know, getting older. She goes, it's not for sissies.
No.
And of course, my favorite is, you know, getting older sucks, but consider the alternative.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
True. Although, like I said in my latest essay on my website, the alternative would just be another adventure. We just don't know where it is or what it is. But I mean, I figure our adventures don't stop no matter where we are.
At least we hope not.
Yeah. True.
And if they do, we won't know the difference anyway, so there's that.
Right, that's true. It'll just be very peaceful there. Very quiet.
Your website also mentions that a couple of your books received Reader's Favorites Awards. Can you tell me a little bit about
yeah.
that?
Sure. Angels on Overtime has won a couple of awards in inspirational fiction. And Fresh Off the Starship won an award in visionary fiction. So that's why I can't call them romances.
And what are readers' favorites awards? Who puts that on and how does it win that?
There's an organization called Reader's Favorite, and they do reviews, and they have an award ceremony every year. And I went in, I woke up, and the 1st of September is when they announce it. And so I woke up at the crack of dawn and looked at it, and I said, Steve, I won an award. Wait, I won 2 awards, and they're going to give me an award cup. And he said, you mean a trophy? Really early in the morning. And then we went to the awards ceremony in November, and that was so much fun. It was one of the best weekends of my life. It was really a great time. And I noticed they had the award deadline recently, and I hope they can have the ceremony for the winners and not have it just be virtual. We'll see what happens.
How do books get nominated for that?
Well, you self-nominate, or your publisher sends it in. And the other place I got an award was the Feathered Quill. They have their own awards categories. And then another one was the Wishing Shelf. There are tons of awards places. But as you were talking about earlier, that's one thing that is another gatekeeper for better fiction or not so good fiction, with all these people doing all the self-publishing these days. If it's won an award, that's a pretty good sign that it's worth reading.
That is true. That is true. So let's talk about your road to publishing. How did you get your first book published, and how was it published, and have you tried different methods of publishing, or, you know, just talk about that.
Yeah, my first book that was published, it was back in 2001, and it had a publisher, and by 2008, I mean, they didn't really, an author still has to do all the marketing, whether you do it with a publisher or self-publish. So by 2008, I just arranged to take it back, and I republished it with my book about Mary Magdalene. And then self-published. That's when Amazon was just getting going. I remember on the day, on launch day, my book did better than Dan Brown's book that day. And I just remember being very touched. But there were so fewer books back then. So, and then in 2013, I self-published Angels. And then over the last few years, I've self-published 3 books. And then, like I said, I have a top New York agent helping me with my latest book to get that to one of the top 5 houses.
Now, what method do you use for self-publishing?
Just Amazon. I do have a distributor that I started working with a couple years ago. So that's different than what most people have. Most people just put it up and hope for the best. I did get a distributor, and so they help get it into bookstores and get them into bookstores and onto other things that I wasn't involved with, like Kobo. And I mean, I was in Barnes and Noble, but there were a few more places that I hadn't gotten into, like iTunes and things like that. I do audiobooks too. I love reading my books out loud.
Oh, cool. How do you produce the audiobook?
Well, I have, speaking of award-winning, I have an award-winning audio producer here in town. He was nominated for a Grammy. And an interesting thing about him is he's blind. So he is so into the audio aspect of life, and he's extremely talented, and I just love working with him. I love reading my books out loud because I can hear it the way it originally came to me and try to speak it that way. Usually I succeed, almost always.
So back to the self-publishing. Now, were you doing print on demand or were you doing print runs that had to be stored
Both.
somewhere? And okay. And
Both. I do, yeah.
so like in what situation would you use one or the other?
Well, I did the print. I mean, I always do print on demand through Amazon and Barnes and Noble and everything. And I did a print run for Mary Envisioning back in 08. But these days I go with Ingram. So if a bookstore wants to buy books to sell, they would get it from Ingram. So that's what
Okay.
I would recommend. Yeah.
Okay. And so do you have to commit to a certain volume with Ingram?
No,
No. Okay.
which makes it very convenient. Yeah.
Yeah. So in a way, they're printing on demand for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I remember back in the day when self-publishing was they was called Vanity Press, and
I remember those days.
yes, and authors had to do a print run of 5,000 books, or maybe the minimum would be 2,000 or something like that. And so you'd have boxes and boxes in your garage and distributed there
Yeah, they
from
take
there.
over the
And
garage.
yep. So it's nice that you don't have to do that anymore. But there's still the one of the issues with any kind of print on demand, of course, is that the cost of printing per copy is going to be much, much higher than if it's printed on an offset print press or even a digital press with where you're running a large number of copies at one time. Your actual print cost is going to be much lower. So with the print on demand, there's not as much of a margin.
Right.
But on the other hand, the author is usually taking all of it rather than getting a small portion of it, with the publisher getting most of it. So I'm not quite sure, but then you have so many more books out there. So I'm not quite sure how the whole self-publishing revolution has impacted authors financially, whether it's been a boon or or the opposite.
For some authors who really get a viral hit or something like that, it's been wonderful for them. I think for most authors, it hasn't been so wonderful, and maybe they kind of give up and don't continue. So, but I did hear recently that self-publishing is still only 20% of the whole publishing revenues. So the big publishers are still 80% of the market.
They're not 80% of the books, but they're 80% of the market.
Right,
Yeah,
right.
yeah.
Of the proceeds
Of the proceeds.
of the,
Yeah, that makes
yeah.
sense. Yeah. So how do you, as when you're self-publishing, how do you market your books? How do you bring attention to them?
The biggest help is places like Written Word Media, where you drop your price and you advertise with them, and they send it out with their daily email. A big one is BookBub. If you can get on BookBub, that's really wonderful. They send out, I don't know, a million emails or something like that. So I do recommend those, and a lot of them are not very expensive. It's like maybe $60 to promote a book and just to help them give that bump. And then social media is another way, and word of mouth. They say word of mouth is still, even in this digital age, it's still number one. Of course, that word of mouth can be digital, but
Right.
but
True.
more than tweeting your own stuff or putting your own book cover up on Instagram or something, having other people talk about it is still the number one thing.
Do you do book readings? Do you do your own book
I
tours?
I have done book readings. I've done a few lately, on Instagram live, because we can't get out there, and that's been fun. That has been really fun. So, and my comedy friends are doing some comedy out there.
Oh, very
There's
cool.
a lot. Yeah, there's a lot going on Instagram Live and Facebook
True. And Zoom meetings, Zoom webinars,
Yeah.
and Zoom meetups, and yeah, there's been so many, people are learning all these new technologies, and I think when life goes a little bit more back to normal, we will still be utilizing them in new and exciting ways. But
Right.
there is still something about going into a bookstore and sitting in an audience and listening to the author right in the bookstore that it's
Right.
kind of hard to
Talk
beat.
about magical. Bookstores to me have always been magical places. That started at a young age too, because when my mom was well enough to go out, we'd go to bookstores. And I just love
Oh, I
hanging out
know.
with
And
old.
libraries.
Yeah, same thing.
And
Love
in
libraries.
fact, I noticed that there's a minor character in your in this book that's a librarian.
Right. True. My mom was a librarian.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, way back when.
That's great. What is the best way for people to buy your books?
Amazon, well, you can go to my website, and like you said, ann@anncrawford.net. And there's no E on Ann. That's a funny story, but I was such a tiny baby, and they wanted a tiny name for me. And now that I'm 6 feet tall, I kind of have this tiny name. It should be Mary Elizabeth now, or
Oh, wow.
something like that. But at anncrawford.net, and there's a link to my books there, to straight to Amazon and Audible and all the other places. So
Great,
that would be the
great.
best place. Yeah.
Well, Anne, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a joy to be with you.
And I wish you the best of luck with your New York agent and breaking into the big time.
Thank you. I'm ready, big time.
All right. And
Thank you so much.
you're very welcome, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.